Hey everybody, happy Friday. This is Trevin McGee from SceneStealers.com. I'm here with Eric Moline and Trey Hawk once again.
Woo!
We're back. We didn't just say we were going to do one and that we're going to do a bunch more and then not do them. We're doing them. We're doing them. So today we've got a couple movies to talk about. Lincoln, Steven Spielberg's new movie with Daniel Day-Lewis about, I think it's like about a car. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then this other movie called Twilight.
Almost as exciting as Lincoln.
Breaking Dawn Part 2. Yeah, I don't know what that's about. I've never heard of it. So, but we have a big announcement at the start of the podcast that Eric would like to tell all of you.
So, yeah, if you guys are, if anybody out there follows us on our Facebook page, you might have seen this invite already. If you don't follow us on our Facebook page, go to facebook.com/scenestealers because we always post cool stuff. Not only from the site and discussions, but also giveaways. And one of the things that we're doing, a big event that we're doing here in Kansas City, is on Tuesday, November 27th, Boulevard Brewery is giving some of their brand new seasonal beers.
Mm.
And the Alamo Draft House is having a big feast, a beer feast is what they're calling it. And Scene Stealers is going to be hosting a screening of the classic early 80s comedy, Strange Brew, The Adventures of Bob and Doug McKenzie. And if you know me at all, you know that that is one of the movies that I grew up on. I've probably seen 40 or 50 times, and that is not an exaggeration. And I really think it's truly underrated and truly brilliant. Yeah. And anybody who hasn't seen it deserves to see it with a nice crowd. Now, again, or not again, this is the first time I've mentioned it, the theater only holds 58 seats.
Yeah.
So it's going to sell out. We have the RSVP up on the events on our Facebook page. You can find it there. But unless you go to the Alamo Draft House website and buy tickets, it'll sell out.
Yep.
And you'll be stuck RSVPing on Facebook and wondering why the hell you did that. So go to the Alamo Draft House KC site. I'll put a blog up about it too. By the time you hear this, it will have been put up.
Oh, the future.
Yeah. So anyway, Strange Brew, Beer Feast, Scene Stealers, Alamo Draft House.
Recently renovated Alamo Draft House, we should say. I got to go to one of the screenings earlier this week, and really great what they've done with the place. New seating, new ordering, new ticketing system. They've expanded their menu. I think you're going to like it a lot, so you should definitely go.
And you were just there too,
right? Well, I went to one of the feasts before they renovated
Princess Bride,
and it's a blast. You know, they really pull out all the stops. I mean, the venue, it's small, it's intimate, you feel like you're watching it with a bunch of other people, mm-hmm. you know, that love the movie also. I went to the Princess Bride feast, and so they had a whole themed menu. This menu is going to be a beer feast, as thematic as you can get with Strange Brew.
Yeah.
Right. It should be
American beers for a Canadian movie. Maybe someone will smuggle in some Molson.
Yeah.
Who knows? So let's go ahead and start talking about Twilight. I know just everybody wants to know, does it hold up to the others?
We're talking about Twilight 5, right?
Twilight 5, Breaking Dawn Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
And you walking into the theater, I had...
That's always bad when it starts with like the walk up.
First of all, I've seen all of the other movies. I wasn't coming into this film blind. I knew what I was getting into.
And your opinion of the other movies?
I went to the first one because a friend of mine was an office PA on that, and we went to the Arclight in L.A. Mm-hmm. just to see his name huge on the screen. And we had to wait through about 15 minutes of credits because he was an office PA, so he is as low as you get on the totem pole. But I remember walking out of that and thinking, oh, that wasn't as bad as I thought it could get.
I agree.
And then New Moon and Eclipse showed me what I was missing with the first one and showed me exactly how bad it could get.
Yeah.
And then finally, and the reason I watched those is because I had mentioned that I was going to watch, you know, Twilight with a friend in LA, and Jamie was like, oh, that sounds like silly fun. Why don't we watch this? And Jamie's my wife for those listeners out there. And so we watched the first couple because I got them simultaneously in the queue. And by the time we got to the third one, she had kind of tapped out. I was invested, and the DVD was there, so I watched it.
You got to go through with it.
And so then when I got Breaking Dawn Part 1, just so I could go and do this review of Part 2, Jamie couldn't even make it 10 minutes in. So I was stuck and abandoned by myself to watch this movie. I thought Breaking Dawn Part 1 was genuinely awful. I thought it was horrible. It's basically, you know, insecurity about having sex, skip over the sex, repercussions for having sex. So it's basically all of the worst parts of sex in a two-hour movie. And so I thought the puritanical view of sexual relationships was just awful, hideous.
That's not new, though. That's been there since the beginning.
I know. Yeah. I understand. But I thought how accentuated it was. It was like, hey, you're going to be really insecure about your performance issues about sex. Then you're going to have sex. And guess what? Your partner was constantly restraining himself because he could kill you. His sex is so good. And then, oh, hey, and by the way, now that you're never going to have sex again because he's afraid he's going to kill you, you got pregnant.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's as terrible a view of sexual
not
relationships.
Not just pregnant, but pregnant with a monster baby.
That's going to kill
that's
you.
That's going to crush
like,
you
sex
from
is
the
gonna
inside
kill you.
Out.
Sex,
yeah.
One way or the other. Either your partner is going to smash you or your baby is going to break your
just
back.
Just going to smash you from the inside
and,
out.
And
yeah.
So I just thought, I really think it's a reprehensible image. Even if you believe in the sanctity of marriage and that you should wait and all of that. That just looking at sex as basically this evil thing, I just think is
I don't think
awful.
Anything bad has ever come from that.
So let me ask you this then. I'm going to lead you into the new one.
Good.
My question is, at the end of the last one, which I thought was not the best as well, I was wondering what the future will hold for the werewolf that falls in love with the fetus of the vampire and
that,
the human.
That happens?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. And so
well,
now I want to know, because I know that it was controversial in the books, and I thought, wow, I can't wait to see this on screen. Honestly, I've seen all four of them, and this is probably the one that I'd wanted to see the most since I heard about what happened.
Yeah.
Just to see how they deal with that.
All right. So they do go into some explanation, and that's the other thing, that all of these movies have been overly plot-driven, and the characters have been underdeveloped, I mean, throughout. They've been, it's like, hey, can you make a sullen face like a vacuous teenager?
I don't know that they've been underdeveloped. I think that's all there is to them. I think they've been very developed because they keep covering the same ground over and over.
Then maybe that's the case. Maybe these are just totally vacuous characters and fundamentally uninteresting. But they do explain, because they're definitely willing to explain plot and why, you know, why vampires do this and why wolves do this, because they don't, they don't have enough character to, like, spend any time with them. And so Jacob and all of his Team Jacob followers out there.
The werewolf.
Yes.
The werewolf.
Taylor Lautner.
Yes, exactly. And he did not pull his shirt off within the first 18 seconds this time. They made the 48-year-old women wait. So the werewolf explains that imprinting is not necessarily...
creepy?
Well, it's not necessarily sexual or romantic love.
Okay.
That it's something that they can't control, and that it just, you know, it's one of those things that you can't control, and once the imprint, it's a bond that is a protective and sort of loving bond. And so the relationship that they have in this film is much more like, almost like guardian, godparent, protective uncle type thing.
So it's paternal, even though...
It's actually more paternal than Edward's relationship with his own daughter. So it really is weird, and even more parental.
Edward is the vampire played by Robert Pattinson.
Right. And more parental even than, I would say, you know, that Bella played by Kristen Stewart, that she has with her own daughter.
So basically this whole film has been leading up to what I have to assume, besides this element of the story, I know nothing else, what I have to assume is this huge melodramatic epic battle or ending or something. Does the movie get there quick enough? Does it satisfy any... I mean, I don't know. I can tell that you're kind of out of the game already, but I'm just wondering.
There's a touch of mystery, a little bit, you know, but it's that mystery is solved too quickly and you kind of see it coming. And the most interesting character, and I think the most interesting character throughout the entire series has been Alice, the one that that is clairvoyant, that has her premonitions, that sees the visions. And I think that the rest of the characters have been largely uninteresting. And they take, because of the plotting in this film, they take Alice out of the game very quickly. And that only at the very end does she re-enter the picture. And that, again, is the most interesting thing. Now, I will say that every single one of these films has been a tease. Has been, you know, oh, let's talk about why we shouldn't date. Oh, let's get upset about the struggle between two boys that like me. It's like, oh, hey, now two boys are going to fight over me. Oh, hey, now I'm going to be insecure about performance issues around sex. Oh,
essentially, it's wish fulfillment for, you
but
know,
it's not even
girls.
Wish,
and...
It's not even wish fulfillment because we don't get the meat of, like, what we're desiring.
Well, then they get punished for it, yeah.
right. There's total punishment. And this is the same way. Like, it's build towards this thing. We kind of get the thing... But then there's this fundamental trick, and we realize, oh, this movie is just the same thing, where it's a whole bunch of people talking about doing this thing, and then not lots of doing this thing.
So I have to, really quickly, I know we're wrapping up, I have to talk about Bill Condon, the director of this movie.
Yeah.
His career trajectory is insane because he made a great, great movie called Gods and Monsters a long, long time ago about James Whale, starring Ian McKellen and Brendan Fraser that was fantastic. Yeah. Followed it up with Dreamgirls, which was a big deal, but I thought pretty, a kind of a hollow film.
Yeah.
It looked great, but there wasn't much else to it. And then he does these last two Twilight films, and honestly, I thought the last one was shot very well.
This one, like the last one, is directed... Like, I think the problem fundamentally is with the source material. Although, I'm a huge believer that you can take mediocre source material and make a really good film, but I feel like this is the middle-aged woman version of what something like the Avengers or most comic book films are for middle-aged men, where if you get too far from the source material, you're going to alienate the audience that is already built into it. And not really pick up enough of an audience outside that's just like, man, I wasn't expecting that to be good.
Right.
So you're stuck. You're stuck with the source material. And the source material, fundamentally, I think this is proven over time, is mediocre. It works to get, you know, to get some...
Well, it's interesting because when this series started 5 years ago, I knew a lot of women that I worked with that were really excited about it. And it seems like... As people grow older, the excitement has been waning. And I don't know if that's true or not. I guess we'll find out this weekend when we see box office receipts.
From the crowd that I was there with.
Oh, uh-huh.
And it was, again, across the board, I saw maybe I could count the number of teens on both hands. It was mainly... You know, mid-30s to mid-40s-year-old women.
Okay. Yep. Well, I got two questions then to wrap this up. Number one, where does this rate within the series? And number two, what is your Rockfist rating?
Within the series, and part of this is because I can feel like, man, this cinematic part of my life is closed, and I'm really thankful for that. But then also, there were a couple of things that, you know, on the scale of Twilight were satisfying. So within the series, I might put it like second right behind the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then in large part, that's because I found the others abysmal. And then I'm going to have to give this a minor rock fist up Minor Rock Fist Down, excuse me.
We're going to edit that so that your first one's in there.
No, just keep it. Yeah, just keep it. I mean, because, you know, there are things about this film, and really they're almost entirely side characters. Like the supporting cast, pretty satisfying, pretty interesting, that do kind of engage, and you're like, oh, wow, that's cool.
So it's kind of like Rock of Ages in that way.
Sort of. But because of the CGI baby...
Oh, yeah?
There's a CGI baby when there absolutely does not have to be a CGI baby. The amount of money they could have hired 100 actors.
Right.
You know, each nuanced and looking like the next stage of development in CGI baby.
Oh, so it grows up and so they had to...
Exactly. Well, they didn't have to. They didn't have to. They chose to.
Did it look like the
It looked awful. It looked awful. It looked like the Scott trade.
The morph at the end of the black and white music video.
I mean, yeah, or the new Orville Redenbacher commercials. It looked terrible. It looked terrible, and it looked noticeable. It was like, why are you touching that CGI baby? That is a monster. but because of the CGI baby, it's like it's got to be a minor Rock Fist Down. And again, I don't think the built-in audience for this is going to care about any critical review, any critical responses, why this movie
And admittedly, we're not the demographic.
Right, absolutely.
I like the comment you made earlier when you said middle-aged white men like ourselves have the Avengers. And then the women have Twilight.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But we also inherently, or at least two of us here, think that The Avengers is a pretty damn good movie. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I find The Avengers disdainful. Now, here's the one thing that really bothers me, mm-hmm. is that Twilight is a film about basically two teenage guys. One is, of course, very old, but he's stuck in a teenage dude body. So two teenage guys fighting over a teenage woman. Or a woman, teenage woman. And so it's the type of thing where all of a sudden all of these older women are going and getting their panties wet over all of this stuff. Whereas if you take this movie concept and switch the genders, have two hot teenage women fighting over teen man, and then a whole bunch of middle-aged dudes going to... you know, getting raging boners over that.
Yeah.
The media would be, like, totally disdainful of it. It would be pervy. It would be weird. It would be reprehensible.
But you know what? That's okay, because as guys, we get to see women naked in the movies all the time, and they never get to see
I do
cocks.
Get that. But the thing either. Is I think both sides should be reprehensible. I think there's something really gross about this. It's like, I think it should be gross if guys go and are like, oh, wow, you know, and ogling over teen women. I think it's really gross if adult women are going and ogling over all of these teens.
I say let them have it. We had Britney Spears, and now we've got
Katie Spears. Yeah, but it was gross, too.
I'm not saying it's part of culture. Yeah. It's way more established.
Yeah.
And, that, you know, so they need to have their, you know, masturbatory fantasies.
They need to
have 50 Shades of Grey, so, which is being adapted into a movie.
And that was Twilight fan fiction before it became...
Is that true?
Yeah.
She wrote
it as Twilight fan fiction and then just changed the names and self-published those books.
Wow. Good for her.
Yeah. Digital age. Thanks a lot, Amazon. Thanks a lot for making that.
Minor Rock Fist Down.
All right. We've spent 18 minutes on Twilight. Not technically 18, probably about 15, because we had an intro.
And we talked about The Draft House, which, again, highlight of this podcast so far.
I actually enjoyed Trey's review. Review is probably not going to be nearly as interesting.
Trey's review was good. I'm not saying that. I just, you know, Twilight, man.
Yeah.
At least this is the last one. You don't have to talk about it anymore.
I'm assuming that Trey's going to grill me pretty hard on this one, so I'm just going to start out with, because I know you'll have a lot of interesting questions.
Lincoln.
So, yeah, Lincoln. Do you want to set it up since you didn't see it?
Yeah, sure. That makes the most sense.
We got to give you something to do, so let's push the space bar.
Lincoln is the newest award season film from one Steven Spielberg, and it stars Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln, and is about not necessarily his entire life, but just what he had to go through to get the Emancipation Proclamation pushed through Congress.
This is the 13th Amendment. So the Emancipation Proclamation, they were worried that when the Civil War was winding down, that because he used presidential power to put that in, that it was going to expire.
Right.
And he wanted something real and permanent. And Lincoln, according to the movie and Team of Rivals, the book by Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Which is a great book.
The idea is that he had a window.
Mm-hmm.
He had just gotten reelected, and there were a bunch of lame duck senators people in the House,
right?
And
representatives,
yeah. And he had this window of opportunity to get this 13th Amendment passed to actually abolish slavery in the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
so that after the war was finished, people will have fought for something. There was this great feeling I got from the film that Lincoln felt like the war had to be done, but he also felt like it needed to stand for something. And so he's trying to push this through, and knowing that these senators will no longer... These representatives will no longer be in office.
Right.
They could make a vote and then not necessarily be held accountable for it. And that he would offer them jobs and offer them things and do a lot of backroom dealings,
yeah.
which are handled in the film by James Spader, John Hawkes, and Tim Blake Nelson. And yes, James Spader is as... you would think he would be, which is interesting in this movie because everything else in this movie is so stoic. No, it's not stoic. It's austere. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with Daniel Day-Lewis's performance. I can't say enough about it. I've seen The Master. I thought Joaquin Phoenix was amazing. Every time I see movies at the end of the year during awards season, I have to start thinking about awards.
Right, right, right.
And Daniel Day-Lewis is kind of a shoe-in here. We all know he's one of the best actors around, and he absolutely inhabits this role and makes Lincoln seem like a person and not just a figure. And for one of the most iconic figures in the history of history... to be able to do that is pretty miraculous. And he does it by letting the words and the thoughts of Lincoln speak for themselves. In other words, what he's not doing is perhaps what actors have done when they've done Lincoln-Douglas debates,
yeah.
right? Or the actors that have portrayed him in the past, Henry Fonda and whatnot, where they actually have... This version of Lincoln that has been memorialized, the version of Lincoln
deep
that we see...
And so
during this 4 month period, the film focuses on the political backroom dealings that Lincoln and his cronies did to make this happen. In addition, there are all these little subplots that are happening about the Civil War winding down, his strategy to keep the South from making a deal before. Because he wanted to get the amendment in there,
right.
and he was worried that if the war ended before then, that they wouldn't do it. The subplot of Mary Todd Lincoln being bipolar and out of control. The subplot of his eldest son wanting to go fight after his youngest son had died unexpectedly years ago, and how that tore the family apart. And all this stuff is just woven into the fabric of the film by Tony Kushner, the playwright who did the screenplay here,
mm-hmm.
so skillfully that it doesn't none of Spielberg's normal overt sentimental tendencies can destroy the real kind of vibe that you
emotional
get from
depth.
All this. Yeah. That said, this is not an emotional film. When it all wraps up, you feel like you've seen something that is very interesting and works on a lot of different levels. And certainly as a parable for what's going on in politics today, I think Lincoln could not be more timely because, you know, you've got Obama pushing the healthcare initiative through a couple years ago and Republicans complaining that the way that he did that was just so dirty. And so awful,
right?
Sure.
Right? Well, watch this movie, and yeah, exactly, and understand that that's how our system works.
Right.
And if you want to get something valuable, something real through Congress, it's not going to be easy.
Right.
And so anyway, there's that
democracy.
Well, honestly, I'll tell you what, man. Watching Lincoln made me realize. This is how democracy is supposed to work.
Right. Yeah.
And if it does work this way, that's okay because it's actually making a difference and it's making a change. And I think that one of the reasons this didn't come out before the election is because a lot of critics, I haven't read any reviews of this film yet, but I'm assuming a lot of critics are going to make this connection. And this would have been very big for Obama, for people to see a president who has a moral – feels like he has a moral imperative mm-hmm. to push something through a gridlocked Congress. And like I said, It's not Spielberged too much. John Williams' score has some moments where it swells up and you know, it
tells
does
you exactly what to feel.
Yeah, a couple times that happens. And there's certainly one scene towards the end of the movie, but we know what's going to happen there as well. We know he's going to get assassinated. And so I think actually he pulls back from that as well, Spielberg does. I'm not going to say there's no traces of Spielberg. I think he is a terrific filmmaker. War Horse and Amistad for me are at the opposite end of Spielberg's historical type dramas, and I think that this movie is way different from those films. And just coming from a year after War Horse, it's really impressive to see something like this that feels thoughtful and considered and adult. Now that said, like I said before, it's not hugely emotional. When this film's over, you don't walk out of it going, oh my God, I just feel changed and moved. And I think that, again, I'm going back to the Oscars, that might not work in its favor when it comes down to the Best Picture race. But I thought it was a terrific film. And ever since seeing it, I've wanted to go back and revisit it and see more how it was put together, because it just really worked for me the first time.
Yeah. So he doesn't, at the end, there's not the big swell when they get the 13th Amendment passed, and as we're building towards the assassination, there isn't that big, because that's what Spielberg always does
right.
to me. And this is what my fundamental problem with him now is, that a lot of at least this current crop, the 70s crop of directors who grew up in the 70s, who were the first film
school brats,
yeah, exactly, that as they have aged, they have started pulling back from a lot of their ballsy moves that they would make early on, having confidence in their audience, knowing that their audience could take a push and, and all of that.
You realize we're talking about the guy who did Jaws though, right?
Right. I mean, I get
and
that.
And the guy who scored it.
I do get that. Also Close Encounters. Close Encounters doesn't have necessarily easy answers. It's ambiguous at the end. It does, it does leave some to the imagination.
There's an interesting way that they that Spielberg and Kushner give us the a little bit of an emotional punch after it passes.
Right.
And to answer your question, I'd have to go back and watch the movie again, because it's been a while since I've seen it, about that actual moment. But I do remember feeling like, wow, this isn't as manipulative as it should have been when that moment happens.
Then there's
a moment that comes in afterwards with Tommy Lee Jones that gives us the emotional weight that we need for that scene. That felt very Spielberg, but it also felt like I craved that at that moment. This movie is so measured that it's almost like, had Spielberg done that the whole time, it would have been really annoying. But there's a couple moments in the film where, God damn it, you want that, because this movie is just, I think that because it concentrates so much on the political aspect of it, that mainstream audiences might be a little alienated from this film. And I think that it is to its strength that the film works as an examination, a re-examination of history. I think a lot of people will understand things about this moment in time that were previously glossed over in history books.
Yeah.
And for that reason alone, and the fact that it does feel real, this doesn't feel like a bunch of Hollywood actors, and there's a million actors in this movie, David Strathairn, Bruce McGill, character actors like that, all over the place, Walton Goggins, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he's not in the film that much either, but there's tons of people in this film.
Sure.
But it doesn't feel like play acting. It actually feels like we're there, we're in the moment. And the language is fantastic. The speeches by Lincoln and the moments where he tells stories to people, which have become this thing of legend, they're all great.
Yeah.
And the language, just like, it's not poetic, but it just sounds like it's poignant, right?
Yeah.
And I know that sounds cheesy, but if you've ever read any of Lincoln's old speeches, you realize this guy had a way with words. And in the movie, he doesn't deliver them like he's a prophet. He delivers them like he is a real person and he believes in what he's saying. And that's absolutely the reason that the movie works.
Cool. Well, so, I mean, that gives me hope, you know, knowing that this is a Spielberg film.
How many shots of people looking at things are there?
Isn't this a movie about people looking at things?
If you had to count, how many times does somebody look at something off camera?
How many reaction shots?
How many reaction shots?
Well, there's not that much amazing stuff to look at. Right. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just a bunch of, you know, people and candlelight.
I'm kidding.
But no,
what's your rock this rating? Let's get down to brass tacks.
I haven't even thought about this yet. It's either solid or way up, man. This is a great movie. It's one of the best movies I've seen this year. It's probably in my top five.
What would keep it from being a way up? What holds it back from that?
I like movies that punch me in the gut or movies that make me feel alive. And this movie is more procedural than that. Okay. And I think that, that's its biggest weakness. For that, I suppose I might have to give it a solid rock fist up and not a rock fist way up, which means that I like Cloud Atlas and Killer Joe better than this movie.
Yeah.
I hate rating systems.
That's weird. That's Jesus. Weird. That's a weird thing.
Yeah.
Now, I haven't published my review on the site yet, so we'll see where that stands. But right now, it's solid.
All right. Great. Well, those are the two movies we've got for this week. We're going to wrap it up because we're over the 30-minute mark. But we'll be back next Wednesday, actually, where we're going to talk about Life of Pi and Silver Linings Playbook.